Joining us,
don't be a smart aleck.
Robert DeLaurentia.
Laurentis.
Yes. Right, there you go. That name. Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys got it. Perfect.
Well, wow, you're very forgiving.
And very encouraging, I might add.
And it says Zen Pilot. Now, of all the things we've seen on a uniform, Zen Pilot is not one of them.
Well, you know, on the trip, I started out as the Zen Pilot, and when we were filming the 12-part docuseries, it was about finding peace in the world. And we talked to a guy named Flavio, a paraglider pilot out of Rio, and he said, before you can find peace in the world, you need to find it in yourself. So the docuseries took a dramatic turn because we thought, well, how can we talk about peace unless we find it inside of us? So I ended up in a monastery in Montserrat when COVID hit.
Okay.
Eventually moved to a place called the Zen Villa. And then later in Ethiopia would meet a guy who lived in a cave, a monk, for 70 years.
Wow.
And it was during that time I felt like I found my inner peace. You know, as tragic as COVID has been, it also created some opportunities for personal growth. And that, I believe, came out in the docuseries and also in the book, both called Peace Pilot to the Ends of the Earth and Beyond.
So finding Zen within yourself is not necessarily about changing yourself, but it's being about making peace with yourself.
I think there's some evolution that happens as well, but yes, finding, you know, peace within yourself. You know, during COVID, we let go of a lot of things. A lot of it was ego, too, because we weren't defining ourselves by the things we wore, the things we bought, you know, the things we were doing, because we were kind of locked up in Spain. So that was a great time to figure out what was important to me and, you know, figure out how we could reach out into the world.
Wow. That's very deep for a Friday morning.
Especially for our
us,
program.
Yes. Yeah. It's deep for us anytime. You've written a children's book.
I've co-written a children's book with one of my mentors, Susan Gilbert. And it was funny because in the two years leading up to the trip, the preparations were intense. But we felt like releasing that book was important. So we made time. We wanted to inspire the next generation of youth. And the plane has actually become a mobile STEM lab after the trip. So we display some of our scientific experiments, including a NASA wafer scale spaceship that I carried with me that took 700,000 pictures.
Oh my.
During the trip. Plastic particles experiment for Scripps. Biofuels, first time over the North and South Poles. ADS-B out, first time over the North and South Poles. And then, of course, you know, this book and a Redbird flight simulator programmed with the South Pole flight.
Wow, I'm totally blown away here.
There's a
lot more behind this than just a children's book.
Yeah, no kidding.
So
we always thought that the Citizen of the World, the name of the plane, was really a vehicle for this message. And mm-hmm. we like to think it goes beyond aviation. And even the Smithsonian has done a 30-minute segment called STEM in 30. We're talking about doing more, and we're trying to go outside of aviation and draw this huge net across the planet to pull people into aviation. And connecting the North and South Poles, the two places where peace has always existed, was a way to do that. And, you know, the excitement, the adventure, the scary moments on that trip will certainly, I think, get people's attention.
Wow. The scary moments are like, why am I here? What am I doing? I could have been home, you know?
You could be at home on the sofa.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're over the pole, you're not only thinking, ooh, this is a scary moment, but darn, it's cold out there.
That would be my first impression.
Minus 60 degrees Celsius, which was well below the gelling point of fuel and the operating temperature of the two Predator drone engines.
Ouch.
Wait a minute. Somebody gave you Predator drone engines to put on your airplane?
Predator B drone engines, the Honeywell TPE-331-10Ts, 1147 and 1150 horsepower.
I want to know who you know.
Yeah, really?
Well, it does say NASA on his flight suit, so he's got some connections.
I have some connections.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, it was really a mission of many, and 95 sponsors and supporters. AOPA was a huge one. Honeywell. Boeing, Lightspeed. I mean, the list is very extensive. Even Artcraft Paint put a new paint job and interior into the plane. I mean, it is beautiful.
What is the plane?
Thank you.
The plane is a very highly modified Turbine Commander 900. It's the model that Gulfstream built for about 3 years.
Okay.
So Rockwell was before them, and then came Gulfstream. So every time a company would buy this plane, they would make improvements. Some of the improvements included these TPE engines, a 52 feet quarter inch wingspan. So the wingspan grew by 10 feet. Pressurization increased so I could fly at RVSM altitudes of 35,000 if necessary. A new environmental system by Peter Schiff. In total, you know, 50 modifications, including 6 extra fuel tanks and 20 valves to operate them.
Wow.
And I would say one Wampen heater, too.
Well, that was Peter Schiff.
Yeah, multiple heaters, actually.
It's a wood stove. It's got to go back and stoke it every now and then.
That's right. To keep that fuel from gelling, were you actually heating the tanks on this aircraft?
Well, there's a guy named Fred Sorensen, amazing person in the aviation industry, over 500 Pacific crossings. He designed this system for me. And what we did is we knew that the Jet A fuel A1 would gel at minus 47. We knew it'd be coming out of a Bowser at Ushuaia, Argentina, close to freezing. So the 5 of the 6 tanks were inside the plane. So it would be heated inside the plane. And then we found a route through the pressure chamber, through the skin of the ship, the wing route to the first, you know, to the fuel pump, heat exchanger, friction over the wing. And we felt fairly confident that it would not gel in that time. But if we were wrong, I'd lose both engines.
Yeah, that's a pretty big wrong.
Yeah.
And it worked.
It worked. I'm here.
Yeah.
And we did it the first time, which is something to be said. You know, when you take an aircraft that's designed to go 6 hours and you fly it for 18.1 nonstop with fuel reserves, you're asking so much of that aircraft and the pilot. I was fortunate enough to find the engineer who had designed the wing for Gulfstream back in 1983. He was, I believe, close to 90 years old. And he said, "Hey, I'm retiring next week." I said, "You got to do one more project."
No. But he did it.
He did. You know, some people were intimidated by the trip. They thought the risk was too great. And others were supporters, believers, dreamers, just like me.
It's, you know, that's the part you never hear about. Oh, so-and-so flew over the pole. You don't hear about the 150 people behind him that made it possible.
I have some amazing people behind me. Mike Jesch, a commercial airline pilot, Brian Keating. He was nominated for the Nobel Prize, and he was the guy who was telling me the dates I should be over the North and South Poles. He introduced me to NASA, one of my very good friends.
Nice. What's his expertise? It sounds like weather or climate.
He's an astrophysicist, and he has microwave telescopes at the South Pole and other places across the planet.
Interesting.
Yeah, serious.
Sounds like a heck of a guy.
Did you fly this solo? It sounds like you did.
I flew the flight solo. I did have a mentor with me through Africa, just sort of to celebrate the mission. It was this lady, Susan Gilbert, who co-wrote the book, The Little Plane That Could, with me. But all the really scary, dangerous parts were by myself.
Okay. Wow. So let's talk about The Little Plane That Could.
Sure.
This story came from...
Well, a good buddy of mine, Jerry Southern, suggested the title, The Little Plane That Could. And initially the intention was to have a plane that grew up and eventually would fly around the world meeting all these different types of people, just like the book Peace Pilot, and realizing that even though people's skin was a different color, their religion, the country they came from, their socioeconomic class was different, they shared the most important things, which were love of family, peace, safety, security, health, happiness, joy. And that's the common thread, really, that connects everyone. And that was the point of the mission. It wasn't just, you know, a guy gets in a plane and flies around. There was so much more to it. And I had people saying, you know, this was a sponsor-funded vacation. But when 2 fuel tanks burst inside the plane and dump 200 gallons of Jet A fuel and spray it in your eyes, your chest, your arms.
That's not a vacation.
That's no vacation. And to get into the plane, I had to turn sideways because the hatch was blocked by the #1 ferry tank.
Oh, my.
I mean, I could barely move inside there. Immersion suit, you know, survival suit.
Right, right.
And, you know, try sitting in one place for 18.1 hours, too.
Well, yeah, you need bathroom breaks are a problem.
You know, I was going to say food and drink would be 2 other options.
You know, I like to say that, and this is a little morbid, but fear was my constant companion. Because to make it to the South Pole and back, you have to burn more than half your fuel on the way there.
Oh.
So as you pass that bingo point, you know, you have to think, well, I'm hoping this plane is going to fly faster when it's lighter. I'm praying that the windy.com weather report is accurate and I'll get a push from behind. And when I was about 2 hours away from making it back over the Drake Passage, where a C-130 had crashed a week before, killing about 36 people, I sent a text message to Susan saying, I don't think I'm going to make it.
Whoa, that's a scary thing to send.
Terrifying.
Yeah, but you did.
I did, just barely.
How much were your fuel reserves?
I had about 30 minutes, but I was throttled all the way back to 42% torque.
Wow.
Normally I'm flying at 60, so I had just enough power to keep it in the air.
Right, you were mushing along.
Yeah.
And that's a scary feeling because your controls authority is not what it normally is.
No, and you know, people were watching me. I had, through the sat phone store, a Garmin inReach Explorer, and I was up at altitude, and I thought, okay, I'm going to trade altitude for distance since I'm low on fuel. And there was a cloud cover. I was not able to get a hold of the air traffic controller. So I had to decide, do you do an instrument approach and risk hitting other planes that might be coming in when there's mountains and clouds, or do you drop down below the clouds over the water? So as I was descending, I was pretty much falling, right? And people that were watching thought I had run out of fuel.
Oh, wow. Ooh. Wow. Yeah, it looked like a free fall.
Yeah.
All right, real quick, before we got to go, where can we get your book?
It's available on Amazon, Pilot Mall, Aircraft Spruce has it.
Okay.
And you can always go to our website, which is www.poletopoleflight.com. So poletopoleflight.com.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been amazing. We could probably talk for another couple hours.
Definitely.
This is Digital Dave.
And I'm Fast Eddie.
And this is EAA Radio.